One of the younger Bailey girls snorted, earning a glare from both her parents. Everyone was saved from hearing about my work when Bristow announced dinner was ready. We filed through to the dining room and took our seats. There was one place too many at the long table.
Is Willie joining us?
Cyclops asked.
That's anyone's guess, Gabe said. She left in a huff because she was worried about Ivy's opinion of Sylvia staying here.
She was worried about me? Ivy asked. I didn't think she liked me.
Of course she likes you.
Then why does she scowl at me all the time?
She scowls at everyone,
Cyclops assured her.
Especially Gabe's women,
Alex added. When all heads turned to him, he cleared his throat.
I meant his women in the past. Now it's just one woman. That's you, Ivy. She scowls only at you.
He snatched up his wine glass the moment it was filled by Bristow and drank somewhat gratefully. Ivy laughed. Then I'll consider myself fortunate every time she scowls at me from now on. Bristow was in the middle of serving bowls of consommé when Willie sauntered in, a thumb hooked through her belt loop like a cowboy. She smirked upon seeing Ivy, but didn't refer to the earlier argument she'd had with Gabe. He looked relieved.
Consommé again? She said as she sat. I miss our former cook.
It's not Mrs. Ling's fault, Gabe said. There's been a war, in case you hadn't heard.
Rationing's ended. She can get butter now.
Cyclops sighed.
I missed butter.
Willie grunted.
You wouldn't know it.
Are you calling me fat?
Willie slurped her consommé loudly.
Ignore them, Catherine said to me. When Willie is around my husband, he turns into a large child.
Cyclops tucked his head down and concentrated on his soup.
Tell us about yourself, Sylvia, Catherine went on. Gabe says you're new to London. Where are you from originally?
It was a question I dreaded being asked, but one I'd learned to deflect.
Nowhere in particular, and yet everywhere in England, or so it seems. Have you always lived in London, Catherine?
She gave me a brief account of her life, including her years working for her watchmaker brother. Her family had been close to Gabe's grandparents, and she'd been a lifelong friend to Gabe's mother, India.
Are your family watchmaker magicians too? I asked. No, India is the only one left, as far as anyone knows. Gabe didn't inherit it. Inherited magic can skip a generation,
Ivy pointed out with a small smile for Gabe. He didn't seem to notice, however. He was concentrating on his consommé.
Everyone in this room is artless, Willie said, except Ivy.
Oh? I blurted out.
How interesting. What's your magical craft?
I wish it was interesting, but it's only leather, she said. Willie dismissed Ivy's self-deprecation with a wave of her spoon.
Don't sell yourself short, Ivy. Her family are bootmakers, she told me. Their boots are real good. The pair they gave me have lasted 2 years and still look like new. But you don't have to take my word for it. The government reckons they're good, too. So much so, they gave Hobson & Son Bootmaker a contract to supply British soldiers with footwear in the war. Hobson's boots were worn in the trenches by our nation's finest.
Our nation?
Cyclops teased.
So you agree you're more English now than American?
No, you twisted my words.
He didn't,
Alex said.
You admitted it. You're an Englishwoman through and through.
He grinned at his father, who grinned back.
I'm as American as Annie Oakley and Colt Pistols.
Willie pointed her spoon at Cyclops.
You're the traitor to your country with your English accent and your hoity-toity ways.
We all stared at her. Then everyone burst out laughing. Cyclops' accent was as American as hers, and while I didn't know him well, he seemed the opposite of hoity-toity. As the dinner went on, I grew more and more comfortable. Gabe's friends were nice, although Willie didn't look at me, let alone strike up a conversation with me. I couldn't quite work out why, considering Ivy didn't seem to have a problem with me staying. The Baileys and Ivy made up for Willie's rudeness, however, and by the time dessert was served, I felt quite relaxed in their company. The lull, could also be because of Mrs. Ling's comforting food. She was an excellent cook. Her veal sweetbreads and filet mignon were heavenly, and the pudding drenched in a thick sauce was delicious. If I ate like this every night, I'd need to take out the waistline of my skirt. We retired to the drawing room afterwards for port, which I declined. Ivy accepted a glass from Gabe, then patted the seat next to her on the sofa, signaling for him to sit.
Have you heard from your parents, darling?
They sent a telegram yesterday.
And?
He blinked at her.
And what?
Did they give a date for their return?
No.
Her lips tightened ever so slightly, but the small sign of her displeasure quickly vanished, replaced with a smile. Cyclops and Catherine exchanged glances.
I'm sure they won't be gone long,
Catherine assured Ivy. Ivy's smile wavered. Willie picked up a deck of cards and began shuffling them, despite no one mentioning playing. She seemed to be doing it without thinking, as if it was something she did to keep her hands occupied. Perhaps it helped as she tried to give up smoking.
They won't be gone long. They won't want to miss your wedding.
Gabe's thumb tapped the sofa arm. It made no sound, but the military rhythm was unmistakable. I'd heard the drums in the brass bands keeping the same beat in the numerous parades held since armistice.
There won't be a wedding until they return. Ivy understands.
She clasped his arm above the elbow.
Of course I do. My mother, however, is a little frustrated.
Gabe patted her hand and gave her the sort of smile one gives an elderly person who's repeated the same thing for the third or fourth time.
They won't be gone long,
Willie said again, her fingers flipping cards with the deftness of a conjurer. Cyclops and Catherine exchanged another glance.
I hate weddings,
Willie suddenly declared.
Then why do you have two of them?
Alex asked.
I didn't get married for me. I got married for others. Living in sin is all right by me, but some people get a real bee in their bonnet about it. Both of my husbands insisted.
Don't listen to her,
Cyclops said to me, his eye twinkling with humor.
She loves weddings. She always cries.
Willie sneered at him and returned to her shuffling. She made no mention of starting a game, and soon afterward, Cyclops, Catherine, and the girls gave their leave. I retired too so that Gabe and Ivy could have their privacy, although I needn't have bothered as Alex and Willie stayed behind. I was climbing into bed a few minutes later when I heard soft masculine voices saying goodnight to one another. Ivy must have left almost straight after me. I sank into the mattress with a sigh. The foot of the bed was warm, thanks to the stoneware pot filled with hot water that Mrs. Bristow had placed there, and the sheets smelled faintly of lavender. It was a shame I was leaving tomorrow. The hotel rooms I could afford would be nothing like this.
Did you sleep well?
Gabe asked me the following morning at breakfast. He sat opposite Alex at the dining table. Willie was nowhere in sight.
Very well, thank you.
I must remember to thank Mrs. Bristow for the bed warmer before I left and for the other small kindnesses. She'd left me a handwritten note on the pillow explaining how the morning routine worked in the household. To some, it would seem like a trifling thing, but to me, knowing the routine was more of a comfort than the soft mattress. It meant I didn't sit down and wait to be served, but served myself from the sideboard, as if taking breakfast in grand houses was something I did every day. As I sat, I caught Gabe watching me over the newspaper he was reading, or pretending to read. He folded it up and placed it to one side.
We'll drive you to work this morning.
Thank you, but please don't go out of your way.
We're not.
Alex looked up from his newspaper, frowned at his friend, then continued to read.
What happens with the investigation now?
I asked.
We'll watch Ludlow and Lady Stanhope. Perhaps their movements will give us a clue. Cyclops assured me that Scotland Yard will commit as many men as they can to finding Tommy Allen.
It'll be a near impossible task,
Alex said from behind the paper. Gabe flicked him a glare, but Alex didn't notice.
Don't worry, he assured me. I'll have a word with Professor Nash when I take you to work and make sure he keeps the door locked.
There's no need for that. Patrons should be allowed to come and go freely.
They can knock.
Alex folded up the paper.
And the library has very few patrons anyway.
Gabe offered me a newspaper from the pile beside him. He had several, some of them dailies, at least two were weeklies. I sifted through them until I found one that looked interesting and opened it without reading the front page. I gasped as an article caught my eye. No, not the article, but the photograph of the two handsome men scowling at the camera.
What is it?
Gabe asked. I quickly turned the page. Nothing. Both Gabe and Alex were looking at me now.
Show me,
Alex said. I bit the inside of my cheek.
You know we're going to read it eventually, so you might as well get it over with.
I sighed and turned the page back. It's an article about Gabe. They used the same photograph as last time.
The one taken after you rescued that boy,
Alex added.
After his father drowned,
Gabe said heavily.
That wasn't your fault.
Gabe accepted the newspaper from me and read the article. He passed it to Alex, who set it down between us so I could read too. Gabe sighed.
That journalist isn't giving up.
According to the byline, the article had been written by Albert Scarrow, the same fellow who wrote the article that had initially led me to seek out Gabe at the exhibition. While that one was a news report on the boating accident, this article was more of an opinion piece. Indeed, it was wildly speculative and posed more questions about Gabe than factual information. Questions such as why did the boy claim Gabe held his breath for several minutes underwater, and how did he survive 4 years of war without injury? Both were seemingly impossible feats.
This is bollocks.
Alex pushed the newspaper away.
It's lazy journalism.
He's just trying to find answers to a couple of curious events, Gabe said.
It's his job to speculate. It's his job to find facts to back up his claims.
He hasn't made any claims, merely raised the questions. Or can he find facts because there aren't any? I haven't given him a quote he can use.
Then I will. I'll tell him where to shove his speculation.
You'll leave him alone, Alex. He'll eventually give up.
Alex gestured in the general direction of the front door.
And in the meantime, we have to put up with him watching the house, waiting for you.
Gabe's jaw firmed.
Leave it be, Alex. You're frightening Sylvia.
Don't mind me. I reached for my coffee cup and resumed reading the newspaper as I sipped. I didn't take much of it in, however. Albert Scarrow had raised two very interesting points. While Gabe's time at war could be chalked up to luck, surviving several minutes underwater was something else altogether.
The boy made a mistake, he said as if he could read my mind. Children have no concept of time.
As the son of a horology magician, I suspected he had a very good understanding of it. Gabe strapped my large suitcase to the rear of the motor with some reluctance. He tried to encourage me to stay longer at his house, but I refused. It was Saturday and I was only working a half day. I would go in search of new accommodation in the afternoon. He respected my wishes and gave in. I kept the hatbox and smaller suitcase in the back seat with me as he drove the Vauxhall to Crooked Lane. Alex remained in the vehicle while Gabe and I headed through the entrance into the lane itself. He carried both my suitcases while I held onto the hatbox. A short man with a needle-thin moustache and oily hair parted down the middle stepped out of the shadows of the buildings.
Mr. Gloss, can you comment on the speculation surrounding your war record and the incident on the Isle of Wight?
Gabe wedged the smaller suitcase under his arm and placed his free hand on my back, ushering me forward.
No comment.
The journalist whipped out a pencil and notebook from his pocket and trotted alongside us.
How long do you think you were underwater for?
I can't recall. Not that long. I took a breath.
Which is it? It wasn't long, or you took a breath, or you can't remember.
Gabe stopped and squared up to the journalist.
Are you Albert Scarrow?
The man touched the brim of his Homburg.
The one and only.
Mr. Scarrow,
kindly respect my privacy and that of my friends. Stop following me.
I'm not following you.
Gabe's eyes narrowed.
You didn't follow me from my house?
No. I've never been to your house. I don't know where you live.
Gabe's hand, still touching my back, pressed a little firmer.
Then how did you know to find me here?
Mr. Scarrow pointed at the library door with his pencil.
It's common knowledge that the Glass Library is owned by your family.
They don't own it, they're patrons. And?
And I thought if I waited long enough, someone who works there will arrive. No one answered my knock this morning.
He scratched his cheek with the end of his pencil.
I wasn't expecting you to show up, but I consider it a sign that I'm on the right path with my hunch.
Gabe went quite still. He must have realized the same thing as me. If Albert Scarrow didn't know where he lived, then he couldn't have been watching the house the other day. So who had? Another journalist? The kidnapper?
Mr. Glass, what about your war record?
Gabe and I strode away, but Mr. Scarrow trotted alongside us and repeated his question.
I have no comment,
Gabe growled.
You should leave.
Excuse me, miss, but can you tell me what you think of Mr. Glass's incredible feats?
Gabe suddenly grabbed the journalist by the jacket lapels. His fist twisted the fabric, forcing Mr. Scarrow to rise onto his toes. He hadn't let go of my bags.
I warned you,
he growled. Mr. Scarrow's face flushed as blood rushed to his head. Gabe's grip may be tight, but not so tight that the journalist couldn't emit a small squeak. I clamped a hand over my mouth to smother my own squeak of surprise. I didn't know where to look or what to do. Gabe always seemed so calm, but now he was a tower of fury. I couldn't reconcile the man with the bald fist and clenched jaw with the gentleman I'd come to know. Had this side of him been there all along? I didn't get a chance to think about it further. A shot suddenly rang out, and I found myself on the ground, flat on my back, beneath Gabe's body. Chapter 13. Gabe had made sure that I didn't slam into the ground by circling his arm around me and shielding me from the worst of the impact. I wasn't winded, but I was certainly left breathless. I suspected that was more from the close proximity of the handsome man whose athletic body pressed against mine than any physical exertion. Gabe's breath quickened too, warming my cheek. He stared at me, unblinking. Very few people hold one's gaze, let alone with such intensity. So when it happens, it can feel like the ground is shifting. Usually it's an unnerving experience, but with Gabe, it was intoxicating.
Sylvia.
His whisper brushed my lips.
Gabe!
That was Willie's voice, shrill and demanding.
Gabe, get up!
Gabe momentarily closed his eyes, then pushed himself to his feet. He reached down and assisted me to stand too. That's when I saw Willie a few feet away, hands on hips. Alex was speaking to an older gentleman at the door to the solicitor's office, his gestures calming. Professor Nash had emerged from the library. Mr. Scarrow was on his knees, arms over his head. He tentatively peeked out. Seeing no immediate threat, he got to his feet and scampered out of the lane, glancing over his shoulder at Willie as he did so.
Have you gone mad?
Gabe snapped at her.
You can't shoot at people.
She wasn't holding a gun, so I wasn't sure how he knew it had been her.
I didn't shoot at him, I aimed at the sky.
There are former soldiers still shell-shocked from the war.
Willie nibbled on her lower lip, her shoulders slumping.
I forgot about that.
Apologize to Sylvia.
Willie's spine stiffened. She crossed her arms again, flattening the jacket at her hips and revealing the outline of a gun tucked into the waistband of her trousers.
That man wasn't leaving you alone, Gabe.
I had it under control.
He was annoying you.
You can't shoot every time someone annoys you.
The world would be a better place if you could.
She sighed and put up her hands in surrender.
I'm sorry I fired my Colt, but I ain't sorry for scaring him off.
Gabe scrubbed a hand over his face.
His nerves looked more shattered than mine. His comment about former soldiers and shell shock may have been more personal than he made out.
Why was he bothering you anyway? Willie asked. Is he her man?
She nodded at me. I don't have a man, I said.
Woman?
I blinked at her. She blinked back.
No,
he was a journalist, Gabe said.
Willie spat on the cobblestones.
What are you doing here anyway?
He went on.
You were gone by the time I got home this morning. I wanted to ask you if there's anything I can do for you today on the case. Bristow said you were taking Sylvia to work, so I drove the Hudson to meet you here.
Alex joined us just as Daisy entered the lane, wheeling her bicycle. She paused, taking in the scene, then approached.
You look a little stunned, she said. Did I miss something exciting?
Only Willie shooting at a journalist,
Alex said, regarding Daisy coolly.
I didn't shoot at him, Willie cried.
Daisy gasped.
You've got a gun? Where is it?
Willie parted her jacket to reveal the firearm. Daisy's eyes lit up.
I've never used one before.
Alex groaned.
This meeting is a bad idea.
No one asked your opinion.
Daisy turned her back on him.
Sylvia, why are your bags on the ground?
Gabe picked them up, handing the hatbox to me. Thankfully, the suitcases had remained closed. Having my underthings strewn over Crooked Lane for everyone to see would be humiliating beyond words.
I had to move out of the lodging house. I stayed at Gabe's last night. He was bringing me to work this morning when a journalist made a nuisance of himself. Gabe's cousin Willie scared him off by shooting into the sky.
I hate journalists, Willie told her. They're vultures.
Not all of them, Daisy said. I didn't know her when she was one, but I'm sure Sylvia was an excellent journalist.
Gabe, Willie, and Alex all turned to me. Gabe looked disappointed. The other two looked as though they wanted to aim Willie's gun at me. Daisy's gaze flicked between them.
What have I said?
Willie stepped closer. We were a similar height and size, but I suspected she could tear me to shreds if she wanted to, despite being twice my age. My mother's combat lessons would be useless against Gabe's fiery cousin.
I can't believe we let you into our home. I'm not a journalist anymore. I'm a librarian.
I gestured to the glass library.
I stopped being a journalist after the war. All the men came home and there was no longer any more work for me, so I changed careers.
I was aware of my rambling but couldn't stop. Willie made me nervous. She jutted her chin forward.
So how do we know you're not trying to be a journalist again by reporting on a big story?
I'm not.
What big story?
Daisy asked. Willie took another step toward me.
If I find out this is all a ruse to get Gabe to trust you, I'll—
Willie.
Gabe grabbed her arm and jerked her back.
That's enough. Sylvia's not lying to us.
You're too trusting.
He let her go and strode toward the library, one of my bags in each hand. Daisy and I followed, she still wheeling her bicycle.
What story?
She whispered to me.
I'll tell you later,
I whispered back.
She can carry her own bags, Gabe,
Willie called out. He ignored her, and I heard Alex scold her for being rude. Daisy leaned her bicycle against the library wall and followed Gabe and me inside. Professor Nash greeted us at the front desk with a nervous little smile. I suspected he'd heard the entire exchange, but was too polite to comment on it. Gabe set down the bags behind the desk. He looked harried. I had a sudden urge to stroke his hair and massage the tension from his shoulders, but I couldn't even bring myself to meet his gaze.
I'm sorry about Willie, he said on a sigh. I feel like I'm always apologizing for her lately. She's usually difficult, but not always like this. Something's bothering her.
Sylvia's former career, Daisy said.
It's more than that.
I'm not a journalist anymore, I blurted out. Nor do I want to return to that profession. I like being a librarian. It suits me. I wasn't trying to ingratiate myself with you to spy on you for a story or anything like that.
He smiled sadly and touched my elbow to stop me talking, only to quickly let go again. The smile vanished. He rubbed his jaw.
You don't have to explain yourself.
I do, I said earnestly. I don't want you to think I deliberately kept the information to myself to trick you. He clasped my shoulders and dipped his head.
I believe you, Sylvia.
A rush of relief made me feel giddy. His grip tightened to steady me.
I'll have a word with Willy. I'll make sure she believes you too.
Nobody could make anyone believe something they didn't want to, no matter how compelling. I suspected Willy was determined to continue to dislike and distrust me. It doesn't matter, I said. I won't be seeing her again. The unspoken implication being that I wouldn't be seeing him again either. He knew it too. He let me go and stepped back. He looked away and, with a stiff nod, bade us goodbye and left. I released a pent-up breath when the door closed behind him. Well, I didn't think it possible, but today has been even more nerve-wracking than yesterday. Why? Daisy asked. What happened yesterday? I'll tell you after I finish work at midday. I glanced at the door. She didn't take the hint. Why can't you tell me now? Because I have to work. Professor Nash won't mind, will you, Professor?
Not at all, he said cheerfully. Your company is most welcome, Miss Carmichael.
Daisy beamed. See? Now tell me everything. What's Gabe's house like? Is it enormous? Is the furniture made of gold? I laughed. It felt good to laugh. I needed it. Daisy knew just what to say to make me feel better. She giggled too.
Go through to the reading nook,
Professor Nash said, ushering us toward the main part of the library.
I'll make tea. I think we could all do with a cup.
But I have work to do, I said.
It'll still be here on Monday.
Daisy took my hand and dragged me toward the nook as Professor Nash headed up the stairs. Your new manager is a vast improvement on your old one. We drank tea as I filled Daisy in on the events from the previous day and told them both about the dinner party. The professor was not concerned with me socializing when I ought to be working. He was concerned for my well-being and insisted I go with Daisy to begin looking for somewhere to live. I insisted on staying in the library until midday. I sent Daisy on her way after she finished her tea and said I'd come to her place later. Then I headed into the stacks to reshelve some books. They were on all manner of topics, from witchcraft in the Middle Ages to a cult based on metal magic in ancient Persia. I flipped through the pages of each one before slotting them into place on the shelves according to the code Professor Nash had given me. Since the Dewey Decimal System wasn't granular enough, he'd invented his own cataloging code. I planned to take the list home with me to memorize it, but had not yet had the chance. Hopefully things would settle down once I found new lodgings. I reshelved the last book on a bottom shelf, and as I straightened, a collection of books caught my eye. They were all about art magic, from modern art to ancient and even cave paintings. My fingers skimmed across the spines as I read until I reached one focusing on modern painter magicians. I took it to the reading nook on the first floor and settled on the sofa. The light streaming through the enormous window bathed the alcove in a soft glow. I scanned the contents page, then skipped to the chapter on paintings. Indeed, there were two chapters. That in itself was revelatory, and the reason for the division became more obvious as I read the introduction. According to the author, magical paintings could be separated into two categories. One type was for art painted by artists whose magical talent lay in the process of mixing the paint itself. Paint was made from mixing pigments with a resin that allowed the paint to adhere to a surface and solvents to bind the resin and pigment together. The painter magician's magical talent lay in the combining of these ingredients. They could use a spell to create the perfect color and sheen. They could also apply it to the surface with perfect strokes to create the desired outcome, although no spell was needed for that. The magician's innate talent achieved a beautiful result with or without a spell. The book likened this type of art magician to a watchmaker magician. timepieces are made up of different metal components, but the magician is not a copper or steel or other type of metal magician. They are a magician who puts it all together in a way that makes it run smoothly and efficiently. A paint magician mixes the ingredients and applies paint in a way that is eye-catching. The second type of magical painting was quite different. In fact, the magicians that created this type of art were not considered paint magicians at all. Their talent was in the surface the paint was adhered to. Usually it was canvas, but it could be any type of surface, such as plaster, metal, ceramic, or enamel, to name just a few. The stolen Delaroche was painted on canvas, so it was possible Delaroche was a canvas magician and not a paint magician at all. We didn't know because he was long dead and he'd kept his magical specialty a secret out of fear of persecution. I flipped the pages until I reached the detailed section on canvas magicians. I knew a painter's canvas was made from cloth stretched over a frame, but that was the limit of my knowledge. According to the book, canvas is a woven fabric mostly comprised of cotton with a heavy thread weight. The magician who makes a magical canvas is actually a cotton magician. They could theoretically make magical objects of any kind where cotton is used, such as clothing, but they tended to specialize in canvas as a result of family tradition. Cotton was an old magic with many branches of specialty. I didn't see how knowing about the two different types of magic would help solve the theft, but it may be relevant. I tucked the book under my arm and went in search of Professor Nash. I found him at the front desk on the telephone. He signaled for me to approach, then gave up the chair and handed me the receiver.
"It's Gabe. He wants to speak to you."
I leaned closer to the mouthpiece. "This is Sylvia." His greeting crackled down the line.
"I wanted to see if you're all right after this morning's episode."
"I'm fine." I glanced at the desk clock. It was almost midday, time for me to finish work. It would be easier to show him the book rather than try to explain the different magics over the telephone. "Will you be home this afternoon?"
"I'm at Burlington House. There was an attempted theft of the seascape overnight. The attempt failed."
I heard a voice in the background, then Gabe came back on the line.
"Sylvia, I have to go. Are you sure you're not injured from when you hit the ground?"
"I'm all right, thank you."
"Good. Well, goodbye."
"Wait." But he'd already hung up. I returned the receiver to its hook. "Professor, may I borrow this book until Monday?"
"Of course. Does it hold a clue?"
"I don't know, but it's worth showing it to Gabe for his opinion."
"You should leave now to catch him at Burlington House."
"It's still 10 minutes to midday." He waved off my concern.
"Leave your suitcases here and collect them later. And be careful."
With the book still tucked under my arm, I grabbed my purse, hat, and jacket and headed out the door. Despite the attempted theft, visitors to the exhibition were still allowed in and out of Burlington House. Policemen stood at the entrances to each gallery, keeping a watchful eye on the artwork. I paid the entry fee, then asked a constable where I could find Gabe. He directed me to Mr. Bolton's office. The door to the exhibition manager's outer office was open, but the door to his office was closed. The assistant, Mr. Driscoll, had taken that as an invitation to plant his ear to it to listen in. I cleared my throat. Mr. Driscoll jumped. He hurried toward me, his cheeks flushed at being caught eavesdropping.
"Miss Ash, what are you doing here?"
"I need to speak to Mr. Glass. Is he in there?"
"Yes, I mean, I believe so. I'm not sure. That's why I was trying to hear. I couldn't make out their conversation, and if I could, I would have instantly backed away."
The more he protested, the more I didn't believe him. "I'll wait out here for him." Mr. Driscoll seemed to make up his mind about something. He signaled for me to walk with him.
"I'm sure they won't mind an interruption if it's very important."
I hadn't said anything of the sort, but I kept my mouth closed. I was as keen to hear what they were discussing as Mr. Driscoll was. Mr. Driscoll didn't wait for his knock to be answered. He simply opened the door. The unexpected act allowed us to overhear Mr. Bolton mention a name. Tommy Allen. Gabe and Alex both swiveled in their chairs to see who interrupted them. Gabe rose and offered me his chair.
Is everything all right? Did something happen at the library?
I refused the chair. Nothing happened. Everything's fine. I discovered something in this book that I wanted to show you. It might be relevant. I was willing to wait outside. The three men looked to Mr. Driscoll, lingering in the doorway. He stammered an apology and backed out of the room, closing the door. Gabe patted the back of the vacant chair, but I refused again. I don't want to intrude.
You're not. Mr. Bolton was just telling us that he saw Tommy Allen running away from the crime scene. You might as well stay to hear what he has to say, since you're heavily involved in the case now.
I sat, and Gabe remained standing beside me. He nodded at Mr. Bolton to proceed. The exhibition manager sat forward, hands clasped firmly on the desk.
As I was telling Mr. Gloss and Mr. Bailey, I was doing my rounds last night after the public left when I saw a figure near the seascape. Indeed, he had it off the wall.
I thought the police were watching it, I said. He separated his thumbs before tapping them together again.
The constable on duty was in the adjoining gallery, checking on another sound he thought he heard there. The figure was alone in the main gallery. As I said, he was holding the seascape in his hands. I assumed he was about to make off with it. I must have made a sound or gasped, because at that moment he turned. It was Tommy Allen. He dropped the painting and ran out of the gallery. I was rehanging the picture when the constable returned.
You didn't try to stop Tommy Allen?
Alex asked.
I would have if I'd had my stick with me.
Mr. Bolton picked up his pointing stick and whipped it through the air, practicing the strike he never got to make.
I didn't want to risk trying to stop him without a weapon on me. I informed the constable and he went in search of the culprit, but to no avail.
The constable has already given us his account, Gabe told me.
A brisk knock on the door was followed by Mr. Driscoll re-entering. He'd probably been eavesdropping again. He opened his mouth to announce the arrival of the magician sculptor, but Freddie Duckworth pushed past him.
Good afternoon, all.
He went around the room, shaking our hands heartily. His trembled slightly.
I wasn't expecting so many people, but this is an excellent turnout. It's good to see Scotland Yard taking this investigation seriously.
Why wouldn't we?
Alex asked. Freddie drew a flourish in the air with his fingers, answering with a non-answer. He seemed excitable today, like an active boy cooped up inside too long. The wisps of hair he'd so carefully combed over the bald patch on our last visit now stood up on end as if he'd repeatedly run his hand through them. He perched on the edge of the desk and smiled. Considering the reason for our presence at Burlington House, it was out of place.
Can we see the painting now, Mr. Glass? He asked. I am so looking forward to it. I do hope it proves to be magician-made. I know the artist, not very well, mind, but we have some friends in common.
He shot to his feet.
Shall we, gentlemen? And lady, of course.
He smiled at me as he extended his hand. I took it as I rose. Freddie exited the office first, unable to wait for me. I quickened my strides to keep up with him, passing the watchful Mr. Driscoll. Mr. Bolton accompanied us to the main gallery and instructed his staff to move the public away from the seascape. More people milled around it than any other painting. Freddie stood in front of the painting and stroked his chin as he studied it carefully.
Take it down. I want a better look.
Mr. Bolton pointed his stick at two of his staff, who carefully removed the painting from the wall and held it between them. It was the size of a card table surface. Freddie slowly circled it. He got up close, crouching to inspect it from all angles. He reached out as if to touch it, but stopped a few inches away. He was feeling for magic.
Interesting.
What is?
Gabe asked. Freddie circled the painting again, stopping behind it. He waved a hand at the back of the canvas.
It's only magical from the front.
What do you mean?
It also feels different to the Delaroche.
Go on,
Gabe pressed.
I can feel the magical warmth in this painting from the front. The other one, the stolen Delaroche, was magical all over, front and back.
What does that mean?
Alex asked. Freddy shrugged.
But I think I knew. The Delaroche was done on a magical canvas, but this one is done with magical paint.
I opened the book to the relevant chapter.
I found this in the library. It describes two types of painter-magician. One has a talent for the paint itself, mixing it, creating it, and applying it. The other type has a magical talent for the painting's surface. In the case of the stolen Delaroche, perhaps the reason you could feel the magic all over is because the canvas itself held the magic, not the paint. In the case of this seascape, the paint is magical.
That's why you could only feel it on the front, Duckworth, Gabe said, because the paint is only applied to the front.
We all turned to look at the seascape being carefully hung back up on the wall for all to admire. Mr. Bolton asked for the book.
Alex scratched his head and frowned.
I don't understand. Was Delaroche a magician or not?
Unlikely, Gabe said.
Unless he was a canvas magician and he made them as well as painted on them.
It's probably cotton, not canvas, I pointed out. Cotton is the primary component of canvas.
Gabe looked impressed.
You've learned a great deal about magic already.
I think I've learned more about raw materials than anything.
Alex studied the painting, frowning in thought.
So the artless Delaroche painted on a magical canvas, raising his picture from ordinary to extraordinary.
I wonder if he knew, Freddy said.
Alex wagged a finger at the seascape.
But this had to have been done by a paint magician. Is that right?
Gabe, Freddy, and I nodded. Mr. Bolton handed the book to Alex.
The magic in the paint means Mr. Duckworth here could only feel the magic in the front, not all over, as with the Delaroche.
Freddy wiggled his fingers and grinned.
I'm so glad I could help solve the case.
It's not yet solved,
Alex pointed out. I joined Gabe, staring at the seascape.
You definitely felt magic in both paintings, Mr. Duckworth? I asked.
Freddy nodded.
If I were a paint magician, the seascape would have felt stronger to me than the Delaroche, and if I were a canvas magician, the Delaroche would have been more compelling to me personally.
Cotton magician, I corrected him.
But I am neither so. Although I was drawn to the magic in both, neither artwork felt very intense to me, merely mildly so.
The way magic worked was fascinating, although I still didn't quite understand what he meant by felt. Alex handed Gabe the book and he read as we walked away. At the exit to the main gallery, he mumbled an excuse and told us to go on ahead. Alex continued on with Mr. Bolton and Freddy, but I slowed my pace and lost them in the crowd. I doubled back and watched as Gabe stood in front of the seascape again. He reached out, but quickly withdrew his hand before touching the painting, his fingers curling into a fist. I ducked out of sight and hurried for the exit before he saw me. I found Alex waiting by the main exit and joined him. Moments later, Gabe arrived. He seemed lost in thought and even a little troubled. Was that because he'd felt nothing when he'd been near the painting? As the son of a powerful magician, the expectation on him to be special must have been enormous growing up. Had his family hoped and prayed that his magical ability would reveal itself in time, only to be disappointed as the years passed and it did not? Or was the pressure entirely of his own making? Being the artless son of Lady Rycroft could have negatively affected him as he grew up with the weight of expectation on his shoulders. It was possibly still affecting him now. The hopes and dreams of family cast long shadows that weren't easy to escape. Or so I'd heard. My mother never voiced her hopes for James or me, if indeed she had any. She wanted us to remain in the shadows where it was safe. But she never told us what she wanted us to be safe from.
Chapter 14.
Cocaine?
Alex asked as we walked across the Burlington House courtyard.
That would be my guess, Gabe said. I suspected it when I first met him, but now I'm quite sure he has an addiction.
To me, he added.
Freddy Duckworth.
I knew it wasn't uncommon for some men to become addicted to the powder after the war ended. It numbed the pain of their experience, albeit only for the brief moments while under the drug's effects.
It's an expensive habit,
Alex went on.
And he knew the Delaroche was magical.
I finally grasped what they were implying. Freddy Duckworth could be behind the theft. Selling the Delaroche on the black market would give him enough money to buy a lot of cocaine. But he's a successful sculptor. Wouldn't he just sell some of his own pieces if he needed money?
Perhaps that wouldn't be enough.
We walked along Piccadilly, me heading back to the library, the men to their motor. When we reached it, however, Gabe opened the back door and indicated I should get in.
I'll drop you off at Crooked Lane, but I want to speak to the painter of the seascape first. I'm not coming,
Alex said.
I want to watch Lady Stanhope and Ludlow. It's possible one or both hired Tommy Allen to steal the seascape. Following them might lead us to Tommy.
Good idea. Collect Willie and split up.
I climbed into the front passenger seat, planning to remain in the motor while Gabe spoke to the painter, but he opened the door for me when we arrived at the Chelsea address of Arthur Partridge. It seemed to be expected that I would participate in the investigation alongside him. It was difficult not to feel pleased by his easy acceptance. Arthur wasn't alone in his flat. There were three others with him, including Horatio, all lounging around the sitting room. A miasma of cigarette smoke hung in the air, and dirty plates and mugs were scattered about on the tables. The rug could do with a good shake to remove the crumbs, but the stains wouldn't come out without a good scrub. Arthur was a young man, barely 18. The reddish-blonde facial hair clinging to his upper lip and chin was baby-fine and patchy, his limbs long and gangly. He was as slim as Freddy Duckworth, with the telltale busy hands and jerky movements of someone under the influence of cocaine. Now that I knew the signs, I could see it in Arthur and the others. Not Horatio, however, I was pleased and relieved to see. The fingers of all the men were splattered with paint of various colours. Horatio sprang up from the sofa and kissed each of my cheeks.
Sylvia, darling, what a pleasant surprise. What are you doing here?
He indicated the book I'd carried in. I hadn't wanted to leave a valuable tome from the library in the motor.
Why have you brought along some reading material?
I hugged it to my chest, not wanting him to see the title until Gabe had explained the situation to Arthur. I always carry one with me. Gabe opened a window for fresh air.
We need to speak to Mr. Partridge.
When no one moved, he added,
Alone.
Arthur laughed.
Whatever you tell me will only be relayed to them the moment you leave, so they might as well stay.
He indicated the sofa, but the only place left unoccupied had a brown stain. I remained standing alongside Gabe. Arthur formed a teetering pile out of the dirty crockery, while Horatio swept his hand over the table to remove the crumbs. He looked somewhat embarrassed by the state of the place. It was a wonder they didn't meet at his place. It was much nicer.
We've just come from the Royal Academy, Gabe said. Last night, someone tried to steal your painting, Mr. Partridge.
Arthur gasped and pressed both hands to his mouth. The other artists finally showed some interest in us.
Tried to?
Horatio prompted.
The attempt failed. You caught the thief. He got away, but we have a witness who was able to describe him. It will only be a matter of time before he's caught.
Horatio glanced between each of us.
This is linked to the other theft, isn't it?
It's possible.
For Arthur's benefit, Gabe explained that he'd been assigned by Scotland Yard to investigate the theft of a magical painting. Arthur seemed unsurprised, however. I suspected the theft had been the talk of the art world in the last 2 weeks.
We had a magician expert look at your seascape, Gabe went on. He confirmed it's also a magical painting.
Arthur gasped again. Then he laughed. He laughed so hard he snorted through his nose, which only made him laugh more. The other painters laughed too, even Horatio.
What's so amusing?
My parents,
Arthur said through gasps for air.
They told me I'd amount to nothing if I didn't go to university and become a solicitor like my father.
He fell back into the armchair, tears streaming down his face. It was no longer possible to tell if he was laughing or crying.
Arthur defied them,
Horatio went on, since Arthur clearly couldn't.
He insisted on becoming a painter. They threw him out of the house, and now he's going to earn a fortune. Magician-made paintings are highly sought after. When this becomes public knowledge, the prices for his pieces will go through the roof.
One of the other painters slapped Arthur's knee, dropping ash from his cigarette on Arthur's trousers. Neither seemed to notice.
Well done, old chap. I knew there was something special about that seascape. We all did,
Horatio added.
It was his first finished piece.
It was my turn to be surprised. You were able to exhibit your first piece in the Royal Academy's summer exhibition? That is quite a feat. Arthur wiped the tears from his cheeks, nodding.
I was very pleased, naturally, but I didn't know I was a magician.
How can you not know? I asked. Arthur shrugged.
No one in my family is a magician, or a painter for that matter. Well, my grandmother dabbled in oils but never exhibited.
Oh! It was the moment the pieces of a puzzle fit together. The puzzle had probably eluded him for a lifetime, and now he could finally see it in all its completed glory.
She was passionate about her hobby. She used to encourage me, but my parents, especially my father, hated that I loved painting. He hated that she would send me home after I visited her with canvases and pigments. She taught me how to mix paint, how to apply it. But I didn't need much instruction. It was just instinctive.
His eyes welled with tears again. He suddenly grasped Gabe's hand.
It makes so much sense now. Thank you. Thank you for telling me.
Gabe asked me for the book.
This explains paint magic a little more. Please return it to the glass library in Crooked Lane when you're finished.
Arthur flicked through the pages with such eagerness, I grew worried he'd accidentally tear a page.
His seascape has garnered a great deal of interest from collectors of magic art,
Horatio told us.
Do you think they knew?
It's hard to say, Gabe said. Another magician will have felt the magic, but perhaps the fact that it was judged the best piece in the exhibition was enough for it to gain recognition. Do you know many collectors of magical art, Horatio?
Only the one, Lady Stanhope.
Arthur pulled a face.
I know her. She's very hands-on, if you understand my meaning.
Horatio chuckled.
She is not shy in her enthusiasm for young male artists. She has launched many a career, sunk some too for those who've refused her advances.
He drew on his cigarette, then blew out the smoke through his nose and mouth as he talked.
If she knew you were a magician, she'd have been impossible to shake.
She was here yesterday.
Arthur gasped again.
Do you think she tried to steal my seascape last night?
They all looked at Gabe.
What did she say yesterday?
He asked. One of the artists removed a painted enamel cigarette case from his pocket, and Arthur signaled he'd like one. Horatio struck a match and lit it for him. Arthur took a long drag and seemed to relax as he blew out the smoke.
She asked to look at my other pieces, but I refused. None are finished. I don't like to show them to anyone until they're complete. I told her to come back in a month.
He puffed on the cigarette as he stared into the distance, lost in thought.
She was very nice, but insistent. She demanded she be the first to see them when they're done. She told me the reason my seascape had been moved to the best position in the exhibition was because she'd requested it and that I owed her.
I hope you didn't promise her anything,
Horatio said. Arthur shrugged.
I had to. She wouldn't take no for an answer.
You should have come to me for advice. I know how to deal with people who think they're the bee's knees. It requires delicate diplomacy and quite a lot of charm.
One of the other artists snorted.
We know what you mean by charm.
Horatio crossed one leg over the other and blew a smoke ring into the air.
Whatever is required, old chap, whatever is required.
I hope she is the thief,
Arthur went on.
That way, I don't have to see her again and fulfill my promise to show her the pieces in a month. I don't think I'll have finished anything by then.
He joined his thumb and forefingers into a beak shape and pecked at his temple.
I just can't concentrate lately. If only I could tap into the creativity I had when I painted the seascape, it would be easy. It's still there, but I just can't reach it.
Perhaps if you stopped taking cocaine, you'd rediscover it, Gabe said.
The other artists glanced at one another, then sank into the sofa, looking guilty. Arthur merely pressed his lips together.
I've been trying to tell him that for some time, Horatio said with a glare for Arthur.
Maybe he'll listen to you because he certainly hasn't been listening to me.
Arthur looked down at his cigarette before drawing the smoke in with a deep breath.
How well do you know Freddie Duckworth?
Gabe asked.
The sculptor?
Arthur shrugged.
Not very well. Why? Has he ever been here? Once or twice?
Gabe touched the brim of his cap in thanks.
Don't forget to return the book to the library.
Arthur saluted him, although I doubted he'd been in the army. He was too young to have fought in the war.
Yes, sir, on Crooked Lane.
We returned to the motor. I knew without having to be told that we were going to Lady Stanhope's house next. I didn't mention returning to the library to collect my bags. I enjoyed being part of this investigation. I didn't want it to end yet. It was no surprise that Lady Stanhope lived in Mayfair, not far from Gabe's own house on Park Street. The tall, slender townhouse presented an elegant stucco facade to the street, its red door an exclamation mark within the row of black ones. Gabe nodded at a fellow leaning against a lamppost on the other side of the street, his face obscured by a newspaper.
Alex.
Once out of the motor, he didn't look in Alex's direction, so I didn't either. An elderly butler answered Gabe's knock and informed us that Lady Stanhope had guests and could not see us.
I work for Scotland Yard and am investigating a crime. I don't want to intrude, but I will speak to her now. She can either come out here or we can go inside. I assume she's in the drawing room?
The butler's lips pinched.
Wait here.
We waited in the entrance hall. On the left-hand wall was a hall table and umbrella stand, above which was a large gilt-framed mirror. Several portraits hung on the stairwell wall in which the subjects wore old-fashioned clothing. While they looked to be well done, I wasn't particularly drawn to any of them like I had been to the seascape. Do you think any are done by magicians? I whispered to Gabe.
I don't know, but if I were her, I'd keep my magical paintings upstairs in the drawing room. It's harder to steal large valuables from the higher floors.
Lady Stanhope swanned downstairs, dressed in a layered black skirt overlaid with panels of lace embroidered with gold thread. A black silk sash tied at the waist completed the stylish outfit. Despite the somber color of her clothes, she looked almost youthful from a distance. She kept her gaze on Gabe, completely ignoring me.
"While it is lovely to see you again, Mr. Glass, a little warning wouldn't go astray. If you'd let me know you were coming, I could have devoted more time to you."
Now I understood why she was determined to pretend I wasn't present. It was easier to flirt with Gabe.
"We're sorry to interrupt your afternoon tea," he said.
"I would invite you to join us, but I didn't think you wanted to discuss your investigation with all and sundry. You ought to be careful about who you let into your confidence."
She didn't need to acknowledge me for it to be clear it was a dig at me.
"Now, what can I do for you?"
"Do you collect magical art?"
"Yes."
"And you knew the Delaroche was magical?"
"Yes, you knew that, Mr. Glass. It was stolen from my friend."
She tilted her head to the side.
"Are you insinuating that I stole it?"
"We're looking at all possibilities."
She fluttered a hand at her chest.
"Good Lord, you think I did? Mr. Glass, I don't see the point of stealing magical art. I want my artworks on display, not hidden away. My husband and I own two paintings done by magician artists, and both are in the drawing room for everyone to admire. Whoever stole the Delaroche will have to hide it for decades until the world has forgotten about it.
I honestly don't see the point.
Where were you last night?
Gabe asked.
Here. Why?
An attempt was made to steal another magician-made painting from Burlington House.
She stilled.
There is a magician-made painting in the exhibition? How extraordinary.
You know there is. In fact, you spoke to the magician painter yesterday. You visited his home and offered to buy one of his other pieces.
You mean Arthur Partridge? He's a very good artist, but he's not a magician. He would have said something if he were, to drive up the prices.
He wasn't aware, but I think you were. How did you find out his seascape was magical?
I didn't know until you told me just now. I simply liked Mr. Partridge's style. Mr. Glass, these accusations are absurd.
I'm just trying to establish the facts. And the fact is, you discovered the seascape was magician-made yesterday, and last night someone tried to steal it.
It wasn't me. I didn't know.
She reached out and touched his forearm, her fingers skimming his sleeve. He drew away ever so slightly, but enough that she knew he was rejecting her flirtation. The muscles around her mouth twitched as she tried to control her emotions.
This is ridiculous. I'm not a thief, Mr. Glass, and your parents would be ashamed to hear you suggesting as such.
You deny knowing the seascape was magician-made?
Yes. Huggins, see that Mr. Glass